This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, after focusing on the shape of the Toronto election and the number of wards for the last few weeks, we can finally get down to the issues. This morning we saw the first debate, and it was on the subject of the arts and culture, which is a sector that is very important here in Toronto. And five candidates squared off, and we are going to take this opportunity to talk to two of the, I would say, lesser known people in the race. And they're both here in studio with me. We have Sarin Gabrielle-Selassie, who is a lawyer and an activist. She has actually spent more than a year planning her run, and she boasts over a decade of community organizing experience. She's also a millennial and wants to represent her generation. Also, we have Sarah Kleiman-Haga. She's an advocate for safe streets, better transit, and affordable housing. I'm going to give the numbers out again in case you have any questions for either of these candidates. The numbers, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And Sarah Kleiman-Haga, what made you decide to run, and when did you make that decision?
I also decided last October, actually, and I decided to run just because I've lived in Toronto my whole life. I see things, I see the benefits, but I see a lot of the challenges facing Toronto, and I wasn't happy with how our government was responding to the issues around transit, around housing, around how safe our streets were. My 15-year-old was hit by a car when he was bicycling through no fault of his own. Even the driver admitted it was driver error, but the point is our streets aren't designed safely. So issue after issue came up for me, and I decided rather than wait for the government to take action, I would run for mayor.
I'm very interested in the fact that that was the impetus, the safe streets. That's a very big issue for us here. And very sorry to hear about your son.
Oh, he was okay, but thank you very much, yes.
But also, we focus on the Zoomer generation, the older generation, and very disproportionately when there are collisions, and I will not call them accidents, it's older people who get hurt and who are killed.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And our government's response has been to put up signs saying senior safety zones. And if a driver even sees those, usually they're speeding too fast, they certainly don't make them slow down, and it certainly does not make the area safer for seniors. So we have to move beyond signs to actual action.
Sarin Gabrielle-Selassie, what made you decide to run?
Well, I was very inspired by the example in New York of a historic victory, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is on track to be the member of Congress representing the Bronx. And she's a 28-year-old Latina organizer with zero electoral experience and is not a career politician, and managed to orchestrate a political upset, beating a 10-term incumbent. So that is a huge signal in terms of what's possible in the city of Toronto, and mobilizing the working class populations of the city to send a message that working class issues need to be front and center in this mayoral race.
And what are working class issues?
I said earlier, I would like to see a state of emergency declared vis-a-vis affordable housing. In the city of Toronto, everyone knows getting even a box of an apartment downtown Toronto is, we're looking at sometimes $1,500, $1,600. And housing is completely out of control in the city. We heard earlier today, Jennifer Keesmaat and John Tory completely failed on delivering. They promised 10,000 affordable housing units, didn't even meet half of that target, and are here today telling the people of the city that they're going to build 100,000 units. So I would encourage working class people in the city to really pay attention and be critical of our...
Sarah, affordable housing is an issue for you as well. And I have to say, when I see that, and it's interesting that you referenced the candidate in New York. I lived in New York as a young woman. housing was extremely unaffordable because it's, you know, one of the greatest cities in the world, as Toronto is now, right. I think. And people kind of accepted that because, you know, if you're in New York or London, you sort of expect that.
Well, I think there's two aspects to that. Number one is, I agree, it's not realistic. I don't expect my three children to have a fully detached house with a nice large backyard. We have too many people in this city to provide that. But what we can do is provide genuinely affordable apartments, rental housing, great community parks so you don't need your own backyard, great community centers so you don't need, you know, several rooms in your house. So we need to make it is possible to have more housing. And New York has taken some measures to make it more affordable for people. And I think Toronto needs to be much more aggressive on that because we have a lot of space around us and people are leaving. That's not good for commute times. It's not good for our farmland and our nature outside the city. We want people to live here. They contribute so much. So we do have a lot of space in Toronto still available to us if we develop it properly.
Mm-hmm. And Saren, I'm interested in this business about you being a millennial. You say your generation does business differently. How is that playing into your campaign?
I have engaged a pretty large segment of youth from a variety of different communities. And, you know, times are changing. And Jennifer Keesmaat and John Tory, in my view, represent
too old?
A lot of old school politics. They're both, you know, I mean, Keesmaat earns over $250,000 a year in salary, is a city bureaucrat from my perspective. John Tory, I see a lot of parallels between those two perspectives, and I really want to show the people of the city of Toronto that working class people have options, and young people too. I think, again, the American example is a great one because young professionals and millennials are absolutely changing the way business is done in the city.
Uh-huh. Think about millennials. They don't really vote. Not in very big numbers. We are Zoomers, older people, and we vote.
Yeah, I think that in general, there's a lot of people who don't vote because they don't feel government responds to their needs. And so I think what Saran's talking about engaging with millennials is really important. Of course, we shouldn't ignore any group, but I think government tends to focus only on voters and they ignore all the rest of the people. And in the municipal government, there might only be 40% of people voting. Does that mean do we ignore the other 60%? So it really is important not to neglect the people who are voting, but to attract the people who aren't by responding to their needs.
I want to ask some nuts and bolts questions. So in order to run, I'm assuming you have to put your career on hold and you have to find some money. How are you doing that?
Yeah, so I'm a lawyer and I took a full sabbatical from my firm to be on the campaign full time. No doubt John Tory has a significant financial advantage. I mean, he'd raise over $1 million in a very short amount of time. For people listening, you can only donate approximately $2,500 per person. So $1 million is not chump change. And representing...
No kidding.
Yeah. And representing working class people, it's a challenge, but we've seen it done before. And I keep on turning to the American examples. Bernie Sanders relied on $20, $25, $5 donations from working people across the country. And
Are you crowdfunding? Or something like that?
Yeah, so we have, we've done traditional fundraisers, and we've seen even a lot of working class people who are working poor or low income donate to my campaign because they see change. They see an opportunity to usher in a new era. So that should tell you, if you're a working class person who can perhaps barely afford transit but are willing to donate to a campaign, people will do it if they actually see themselves reflected.
And I've taken a bit of a different tack. I mean, I don't believe that you need a lot of money to run. I think you need a lot of time and you need a lot of energy. And I'm fortunate. I've been supported by my partner. I've raised my three kids and that's been my full-time occupation. I didn't have to leave a job. So you do need to have that flexibility to devote the time. But I really challenge this notion that you need a lot of money. Money buys access to people. It buys advertising. It buys lawn signs, that sort of thing. But if you are willing to go out and meet people, you can get that traction. Of course, the problem is the media likes you to have money to make you worth paying attention to. But as I think both Saran and I have shown, if you work hard, you can get noticed. And that's what we need to focus on. Not this idea that money absolutely is a barrier and it shouldn't be. But if the media is willing to pay attention to people who are outside of that, we can do it. So when I realized how much time fundraising was going to cost my campaign, I wanted to really focus on the messages. So I decided I'm not going to spend my time fundraising. I'm just going to spend my time getting out there.
Self-funding?
No, I mean, I'm just not spending the money on traditional things that I don't have a campaign office. My office is the streets. I've funded my campaign to a very small amount, just to
lawn signs.
I said with the senior safety zones, signs don't work. Lawn signs, of course, I mean, they're a conventional part of a campaign. I've looked at some studies. They're not a huge make or break deal. They're a huge, also really from an environmental perspective, there's some issues around lawn signs. So again, it's an area where I thought I could fundraise my whole campaign to try and pay for a few lawn signs, or I could get out and talk to as many people as possible. That's what I chose.
Do you really think you can win, Saren?
I would just like, I love the Cortez quote, big money will not defeat big money. Big organizing can defeat big money. And I am infused about mobilizing thousands of people in the city of Toronto. And I've been able to engage with a lot of communities that traditionally don't vote. And we usually have abysmal voter rates. So,
well, that's one of the things that candidates and politicians need an organization for is to get their vote out. I mean, presumably you know where your supporters are, but you have to get them to the polls.
That's exactly the case. And so it's to do that, we got to speak directly to first-time voters. The experts have told me that my community doesn't vote, that youth don't vote, and that I should discount them. And those are exactly the segments of the population I am targeting, first-time voters. And there will be a lot of first-time voters this election, thanks to my mayoral campaign.
I just wanted to add, I think it's a really interesting question. Do we believe, you know, do either of us believe we can win? Yes, I believe I can win. And when someone asks me that, I just want to ask them, do you believe I can win? And it's not important. Belief,
no.
It's all about belief, right?
Well, then, frankly.
Okay, yeah. Totally fair enough. And if that's important to you, how you cast your vote, then you are going to choose your vote. But some people, they want to vote exactly for what they believe in. And they're not as so concerned about whether that person is going to win or not, because voting is about more than just winning. Otherwise, why have a race at all? John Tory was looking pretty popular. Why bother to run against him?
Well, it's also, if you're looking longer term, there are a lot of, I've noticed, I don't know so much for city, because
right.
Incumbency is really kind of entrenched, but
yes.
That, say at the provincial level, a lot of people have to run once and lose, and then the next time. I mean, you know, you can run with an eye to the future if that's...
Yeah, it's not about arrogance or, you know, living in a dreamland. It's just about, you know, start, set your goal. People enter the Olympics who are probably quite unlikely to win first, but they do it, right? They do it because it's worth doing. I believe it's worth doing.
Well, in sports, they say that you have to believe.
Right.
So what would you say is your main platform? Like, what will you do first thing if you win?
First step is to declare a state of emergency vis-a-vis the affordable housing crisis. We heard earlier this year Jennifer Keesmaat declare a state of emergency around pedestrian safety in the city of Toronto, and as you know, rightfully so. And I'm surprised there's been a little bit of a silence around identifying housing as a complete crisis in Toronto. So that is my first step. I'm also looking at electoral reform issues. I'd like to see two-term limits for city councillors, so we don't have city councillors sitting for 40 years in office.
I think a lot of people would agree with that.
Yes. In Ward 5, Francis Nunzietta has been in city council for close to 40 years. That's not good for Toronto. That's not good for our ward. It's not good for democracy. And two-term limits is reasonable. Yes. And I think that's what the people of the city of Toronto need. And we don't want to see politicians hoarding power for, you know, generations and then passing it down to their children for another generation.
What's your take on transit, Sarah?
On transit, I feel like we've taking it way too far as the politicization of transit. And I feel like politicians assume that they know how to do transportation. You know, you wouldn't go into a hospital and say, oh, doctor, you are not doing that heart surgery right. I'm sure I know a better way to do it. No one would do that. But there is expertise involved in transit planning, in designing our streets. So our politicians need to just decide.
Jennifer Keesmaat has that expertise.
And I'm so pleased that she has been so vocal on that issue. It's critically important. So transit, but what I do find is that both the candidates are talking a lot about the long-term plans, which is important. We haven't done enough long-term planning, but there are decisions we can make today to improve the TTC. We've got the King Street pilot. It's been very successful. Not uncontroversial, but if you look at the data, very successful. That is an approach that's low cost.
Some people question that data because I've spoken to people who say, yes, the ridership has gone up, but they've just moved from Queen Street to King Street. It's not new transit riders necessarily.
Well, I think we would need to get the city person in here to debate the numbers. I mean, they've produced the data. I believe them as a transit user. I certainly find King Street much easier. I still take Queen Street or Carlton Street. But I think the point is that it has improved things on King Street, and it has created more reliable service. And I think we could do that throughout the city. I really do. It costs so much less than other types of investments.
Transit?
Jennifer Keesmaat also hinted at the possibility of a fare-free model. She put a message out on Twitter, and I think the majority of people of Toronto would also agree that TTC fare is rather punitive. So I'm calling for a freeze on transit fares, no more fare hikes, and over 100 cities around the world have piloted a fare-free model, and at this
fare-free or fare-freeze?
A fare freeze on transit fare.
Freeze. So freeze. You're not going to come in and make fare free.
No, I'm not going to make fare free overnight, but I want the city to start imagining a future where transit could be free. There was a time when people thought healthcare couldn't be free, or that...
Where's this money coming from? I mean, the city is very limited in revenue tools.
Yes, so we actually have an operating budget of close to $11 billion, and one possible revenue source that I've been speaking about earlier is repurposing the police budget, which right now occupies one-tenth of our operating budget and sits at...
All of it? All the police budget?
No, of course not. But a portion of the police budget to have a more fair allocation of city resources. So that's reasonable, because I've been saying that we want to tackle poverty and as a solution to tackling crime, and that if we didn't have so much poverty in the city of Toronto, I don't believe that we would see the level of criminal activity that we have been seeing.
A lot of people are very concerned that we're on track to have another year of the gun here, and a lot of people think that we are soft on crime, not too hard. Sarah, what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, the evidence just seems to show that reacting to crimes after the fact is never as effective as preventing crimes before. And prevention involves...
Okay, no one argues that, but we have crime now. So while we're preventing future crime, we have to deal with what we've got now.
Well, I mean, we have a justice system. We are dealing with it. I don't agree, and I don't think that evidence supports that we're too soft on crime. I understand people's frustration and feeling, you know, why do people seem to get away with things? It's a case-by-case basis. It's different in every case. So I think we always just need to come back to making our communities safer, improving relationships with police. I know one of the things that people complain about is that people won't tell who is involved in a crime, for instance. And part of that is due to poisonous relationships with the police. So if we can improve that, we're going to create a closer-knit community that will support each other. And then just coming back to prevention, it's just so much cheaper than reacting. And the reacting is not helping the crime. That's the problem. It's, you know, we have the crime, yes, but throwing in expensive and unproven surveillance technologies, for instance, this isn't, it's spending a lot of money. It's looking like we're doing something, but it's not reducing crime.
Well, a lot of people are very worried about this. There are some people who say that we've seen more gun crime because of, say, the end of carding, which was very controversial. And people want more police. What do you say? And that's a sizable number of people. Mm-hmm. What would you say to those? I mean, how would you represent that view?
Yeah. In 2005, I met with then Prime Minister Paul Martin with a coalition of African Canadian organizations to combat gun violence from a community-based and youth-led perspective. So crime in the city, it just comes in cyclical waves because we see it now. There's going to be increased attention to it. At some point, it's going to subside. There will be an increase in funding to youth programs, and then the cycle will repeat again in 3 to 5 years. What we need to do is actually have a vision towards eliminating poverty in the city of Toronto. Most people will agree that it's not middle class or affluent youth that are find themselves in conflict with the justice system.
Yeah, but how do you deal with the crime? You just say, wait till this spate, which is caused for whatever reason, if there's a gang war, like just wait it out? Is that...
No, I'm saying I don't think we should wait. I think we should be proactive in immediately addressing youth jobs. So rather than hiring 200 more police officers, I've called for the creation of 1,000 more youth jobs in neighborhood improvement areas. We need a preventative approach. By the time the police have been involved, it's too late.
What about you? Do we need those 200 more police officers?
Well, I think we look at the communities where more crime is occurring, and they are not asking for more police officers. They're asking for more youth programs. So if the communities that are the most directly affected by crime are not asking for more, then why would we be wanting to impose that on them? The thing is, carding doesn't reduce crime. So it's something that people sometimes want to seize on because they think they want a solution. And that's understandable. Feeling unsafe is not a nice feeling. So we look for solutions. But, you know, it's not about letting the gangs just go on and just focusing on a basketball league or whatever. The police are there. The justice system is there. We are working on crime all the time. It's about what more can we do. And I think the more is definitely in the area of working with the communities of prevention and working with the police. I mean, the police will have ideas beyond just more police. They'll have other ideas about creative solutions. I'd like to talk to them about that.
Mm-hmm. We just saw a whole pitched battle over the number of wards in the city. And, you know, there's a limit to the power, I mean, that city council has. The city is a creature of the province. The province, I would say, has very, very different ideas on how things should be and how they should run than either of you. So how would you deal with the province, with Doug Ford?
Well, he just slashed City Hall in half. So now we have 25 councillors, which is a small group of people to represent the entire city of Toronto. And this was a time when we really, really needed leadership from our sitting mayor, John Tory, to come forward and say, the people of Toronto have spoken. There are thousands of people who have lined our streets who are not in favor of a 25-ward system. But we didn't see that. We didn't see that bold leadership. We saw, really, him concede to Doug Ford's announcement.
He tried to fight it, but there's, you know, the province has the legal authority to do what it did.
There are legal limits. Doug Ford is not a king. He is our premier.
But the city is still, and I would argue that cities need more power in this day and age, but as of now, they don't have it.
Well, Doug Ford seems to be intent on ruling City Hall from Queen's Park. Invoking the notwithstanding clause was a shock to so many.
He managed not to, but
he was prepared to, even though that has never happened in the history of the province of Ontario. And so it's the writing is on the wall. It's a signal of more to come. And we really need in these times to have leadership that's willing to stand up for the people of the city.
Yeah, I just jump in and say we have to do what we can do. And you're absolutely right, Libby. The province is holding all the cards at this point. So we have to stand up and fund what we can and go in the direction that we can. And if the province comes down on us, we need to find creative ways of getting around that. Now, I think just fighting and yelling is not working. So we need to find ways of working with either Doug Ford or the sentiment behind what he's asking for, because I think people can agree with some of the problems that he's raised. It's his methods that's the problem. So I think that the mayor needs to stand up for Toronto, but also to work constructively wherever possible and find areas of common agreement.
Okay, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to give you 25 seconds each. Saren, what would you like to leave us with?
I would like the working class people in the city of Toronto to recognize this is an important opportunity. It's your election. Vote for a candidate who is actually going to fight for working class issues and fight to eliminate poverty in the city. And finally, tackle affordable housing to actually see us meet the targets that have been set.
And for me, it's just about encouraging all of you to get out and vote. We have very low voter turnout in this city. And I heard a saying that I love, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And that's what's happening when people aren't voting. So get out and vote. Research the candidates to find out their stances on the issues that are important to you. I presented my approach to you. I'd encourage you to go and research who you'd like to support and vote for the vision that you believe in the most. It's October 22nd. Advance polls are starting October 10th. And have a good election season along with the rest of us.
Okay. Thank you so much and nice to meet you, Sarah Kleiman-Haga.
Thank you.
And Saren Gebre-Selassie.
Thank you.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.